Welcome to the Few and Far Between podcast. I'm your host, Chris O'Brien. In this episode, we're going to explore the continuing integration of biology and AI. Is AI the great leveler the scientific community has been waiting for? Today's special guest has his own ideas, specifically in the area of neuroscience. Starting with early stem cell breakthroughs in the 1990s, Dr. Ulla Isaacson has remained one of the key leaders in clinical research in neurodegenerative disease and regenerative medicine for brain disorders, including Parkinson's and Huntington's disease. Dr. Isaacson is a professor of neurology and neuroscience at Harvard Medical School, the founding director of the Neuroregeneration Institute at McLean Hospital, the author or co-author of over 300 scientific research articles, and a valued member of our own BioRossi Scientific Advisory Board. We had the chance to talk about AI and the paradigm shift in the drug development process, the importance of keeping perspective when it comes to applying pre-generated and pre-trained data sets to neurology and other therapeutic areas, and the importance of challenging AI dynamics to get the next big solution to neurological diseases. It's always wonderful to speak with Dr. Isaacson, and I hope you enjoy this episode. For more thoughts on AI, be sure to check on our previous conversation with Dr. Isaacson's Harvard colleague, Dr. Zach Kohane, in episode 36. Okay, let's start the podcast. Okay, Dr. Ulla Isaacson, welcome to Few and Far Between. I've been really looking forward to this conversation about the emerging world of artificial intelligence and its impact on the life sciences.
Thank you very much for having me.
Terrific. Ulla, I know you spend a lot of time thinking about the application of artificial intelligence to the drug development process. You've described this in the past as something of a paradigm shift. Would you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, I think it's a paradigm shift in degrees. By that, I mean that the paradigm is still that you have to solve a problem for a patient using a drug or a treatment. And the paradigm shift is that instead of us starting with a loosely connected idea, say a molecule could work in a certain cellular system, what I see as the paradigm shift is that now we can do everything at once. And that is to connect the clinical trial base, perhaps, that, you know, what are the data that we have from the patients? What is their genetics? Do we have specific biomarkers in the blood, etc.? To very discrete things that were almost separated before, like their blood values of certain molecules. What is their state in terms of how far they progress in the disease? Have they even debuted? How are they even converted sort of into a disease syndrome? And on top of that, all the molecules that connect that system, and to declare myself, I think like a system biologist, meaning I don't think genetic diseases is necessarily organ specific, even though I work on the brain. They usually affect all cells in the body. And the logic is, of course, incontrovertible. When you have a gene expression, even of a gene that puts you at risk for a certain neurological disease that I work on, other cells in the body will also express that with some compromise or other. So what I'm trying to explain here is that I think what AI allows is that all data can be simulated, can be computed, and put into systems that few of us could have imagined maybe 20 years ago.
So you're saying we can manage complexity and complexity of inputs, I guess, or data in a way that was impossible before. Is that a fair summary of that piece?
Yeah, that's a fair summary. And that is, for me, as a user, right, extremely powerful. And I think it's the overarching idea for me. Now, of course, the follow-up question is, does that actually change drug discovery as such? And that's, yes, I think, where you and I can perhaps create a framework for thinking that maybe some will agree with or some will realize has value. But it's not necessary that paradigm shift generates better molecules or better data unless you put them through a certain set of tests.
Yeah, this is a really profound point you've shared with me previously, and that I think many people outside of healthcare, especially who come at this from a technology angle, sometimes miss. In fact, there was an interesting statement that the NVIDIA CEO, Jensen Huang, made at JP Morgan just this past couple of weeks ago, I guess, where he said, "It opened my mind that we could apply the same methodology that we use in computer-aided chip design to help the world world of drug discovery go from computer-aided drug discovery to computer-aided drug design. And that if we scale this up by a billion times, we could simulate biology. So, you know, would you respond to that a little? Do you think that the reference to, or the analogy to chip design is a relevant one, or where does it fall down?
Well, it's interesting, right? Because it's the idea is zeitgeist, what people currently believe, right? Like you can do everything with AI, and you could do everything, including drug discovery. And I believe we need to think about what the limitations are. So while clearly we can identify every step of the drug discovery process using AI, almost like a knowledge enhancer, knowledge is available to me as a biologist, a clinical oriented scientist, drug developer all the time. And it's available to me in a way that I've never had the opportunity to do before. What it does require, though, is my user interface. And I loved one of your previous podcast that you said when you had talked to Zach Cohen, you said, when you really have a perfect AI interaction, you feel like you're talking to the smartest people on earth or the dumbest person on earth.
Yeah. I loved that. Exactly.
Coming back to that analogy is very important. And as big a fan as we all, and I am, of processors and processor speed, what they actually do is increasing the efficiency of the interface it has with me, the user. So, for example, like I mentioned before, I can, which is sort of in a very interesting way, my team can get access to most published data on Alzheimer's disease or even data banks through collaborations and ask very specific questions very fast. But again, it's pre-generated knowledge, right? And I think to keep this in perspective all the time, you need to realize that it's pre-trained, right? So while I can access all those data and get computations on it, it doesn't actually necessarily lead me in a direction that will be useful. And that is hard, I think, to prove to somebody who thinks in chip design, because there are several ways in which we're operating now, say, from a genetic perspective. The analogy for the hype about AI was that when I remember in year 2000, there were several companies that were called basically Millennium, etc., that said, because we had the genomics revolution, we've identified every gene on the planet. Now we have cures for all diseases. And it felt like Christmas and New Year's around that time. So we all kind of believed that. I had a very hard time accepting that. I'd worked on Huntington's disease in medical school, wrote a thesis about it, worked on modeling. And I came to Boston, actually invited by Harvard, to work on the team that discovered the gene. And I thought, this is really challenging. And even the inventor himself, sort of the geneticist himself, Jim Gusella, used to say to us privately, I know these transgenic mice, they are monster mice. Meaning, when you add a powerful genetic mutation, even to a mouse model, it transforms it in a way that may not be physiological. And he was a geneticist. But the story, the feeling I get is the same. And I will never forget, and this is an autosomal dominant disease, by the way, for those of you who don't know, if you're born with that gene, your chance of getting Huntington's disease is 100%. And it's a very interesting thing because it actually debuts around 41 to 46, 7 years of age in all the carriers who has that gene. It's something that's completely genetically defined in neurology, which I work on. There are no treatments for this. And I will never forget in 1993, a New York Times headline that said, quoting a scientist, which I will not name, now we have the gene, now we have the cure. And I remember stepping out of the hospital saying, looked across to my friend, she shook her head too and said, no, it's not going to be that easy. When you want to intervene in a biological network, you're entering a universe of molecular interactions, physiological interactions, intercellular interactions, and as I said, systems disorder. This gene is expressed also outside the brain. It's expressed in many cells, and some of these cells cannot handle it. But the point I'm making is that from 1993 to 2023, there is no treatment for Huntington's disease.
Despite the discovery of this gene, yeah, exactly.
The limitations with AI and chip design is that I believe it's extremely helpful if the interface with the users is in such a way cleverly arranged to create a solution. In other words, I venture to say, Chris, that the creativity is in the interaction between the user and the AI system. And it took me a long time to kind of find words for it. But I realized while talking to many colleagues here at Harvard and MGH, where I work, we actually had a meeting with 10 of us organized by the hostel from the invention office, the what's formerly known as tech transfer. We all were asked to speak for 5 minutes about how we used AI. And there was one person who actually kind of all put us to shame because he said at the end of his presentation, it makes me 20% more effective every day. And in the preceding talks, which I gave one, we all illustrated how ChatGPT-4, without a knowledgeable user, can really fool you. You will get pre-trained, very language-oriented responses that are most of the time very, very smart. But if you challenge it with your own knowledge and say, hey, ChatGPT, what if you consider so-and-so? Wouldn't that make more sense? And it will say to you, in actually a very charming way, you're right. It could be viewed.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Yeah.
On the one hand, as a scientist who have to deal with dogmatic combat situations where people believe in a theory and will discard more efficacious theories very bluntly based on emotion, it's wonderful to speak to a computer that says, actually, you have as much reason as
everybody. Yeah, great point.
But to get back to the chip analogy, I think that may be an overstatement that AI will solve that. And at the same time, I think if you realize in the medical industry, which I'm involved in academic organizations, that is such a powerful tool for us that we feel that, you know, we're way ahead. The other example I'd like to give you is that I thought back of how I operate to get knowledge. And I will never forget being in medical school and doing a PhD that I used to cycle to the library from the lab to deposit a request to get a certain article from that I didn't have in medical library. And that would be sent to me, you know, by mail. And 2 weeks later, I'd be so happy to open a printed version, usually, of the journal we didn't have in this huge library, University of Lund Library or University of Cambridge. And then I remember coming to work at Harvard, and there was a librarian who I befriended who would do these literature searches for me and print out, you know, big sheets of paper. Now, fast forward, I can basically go into not only, and this is a little bit, I think of it socioeconomic, actually, Chris. I have access to all the Harvard University library systems. If I had to pay for them privately, I would have to have quite a cost, right? So I have friends and colleagues who are not working at university and says, hey, I don't have that article. Can you help me? So even in today's
world,
there's a lack of equity. And I can't help but thinking about that. There was a comment at Davos Forum yesterday that actually AI can be a leveler. I can go into any library system in the world now at microsecond speeds and get the knowledge I need. That is an amazing paradigm shift, right? But it has to be probably leveled or put in perspective that knowledge universe is only useful if you know what questions to ask.
That's right.
It has
only as good as the caliber of the question asker.
Yeah, and it's also the user. And that took me a long time to understand that the team I work with or the teams I work with, the way we interact with the answers is there. And I think if you then think that NVIDIA is the chip itself does an algorithm and solves all the problem that no biologists to date have solved. You know, it's a little like asking, let's do the mathematical theorems that nobody solved, you know, and just plug them into a computer. The formal answer, if you follow me, the formal answer, the rule-based answer that a computer gives you is actually what's already known. And so one way of looking at it to be slightly didactic is that we look for edge cases on our teams. What is the case we haven't solved? And why? What is the data we need, right? So maybe I just stop the answer there, because one of the things I think is the biggest challenge in the future is, again, you know, and I remember the first AI lecture I ever went to, which was imaging of various tumors, is data in is as good as what you get data out, right?
Garbage in, garbage out.
Yeah. Thank you for the non-derogative term. But actually, the more I think about it, it's true for everything we do. Currently, we have access to all the data you can think of almost. And I should limit that answer to Alzheimer's in my field, Parkinson's, ALS, all of it's coming out. But actually, when we in my team take the detailed look, we don't have the data on the patient before they develop the disease. We may have postmortem data from a brain, whereas the cancer biologists have a tumor that they took out of the body and they can put in a dish. They are much more effective than we are, and they can use algorithms to find the drugs. We don't have that data set in neurology and neuroscience, right, or psychiatry. So they kind of, and this is where I love the question you had about NVIDIA. When I meet a person in AI, and I work for several companies, and they say to me, we now can solve all the problems in biology that no biologist can solve.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated because I love biology. I think about it every day. And I now have my companion AI. But actually, the interface teaches me that I have to work even harder to get to the next solution. And that is, now I'm making a prediction. I think it's very unlikely that there's going to be an algorithm that creates the drug, because you would then have to have almost a perfect data set with known clinical outcomes, known clinical selection, which is possible if there's an engineer listening, all the individuals that fit that category. And one of the things that fascinates me as somebody who was trained in medicine many, many years ago is that all doctors who generalize are bad doctors. You have to look at your patient and ask them and find out what's specific to them, even within a diagnostic criteria such as Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, right? There are many, many genes, several tens of them for Parkinson's disease. So at any rate,
I can't know what the precursors were. So you said a number of things there. I want to break it down into a few different components. So if I say a few different buckets up front, you talked about how, forgive me if this is an oversimplification, but the complexity of drug design is so much higher, and the interactions are so much more complex that maybe the chip design analogy is a dangerous one. So we talked a little bit about that. You talked about the way in which AI as a partner maybe is a model to think about. I like in chess, they talk about the centaur model, which is that, you know, that the top models can beat any human, but a human working with a top model can beat any computer program alone. I think that's still true. And so I think what you're saying there is that, and this is the challenge, I think, right now for all of us, is to get the balance right on AI, because it is certainly not to be dismissive of these models. They can do extraordinary things, but they have real limitations. I think what you're saying is we need to be highly focused in the way we deploy them, and a little bit skeptical, you know, open but skeptical maybe. I don't know. How talk a little bit about that, if you would. How do you think about when somebody comes with a new pitch?
No, I think the bottom line is exactly what you're saying. So, I mean, to take a step back again, what we're able to do. If you ask us, can you do an algorithm on protein folding? To disclose, I used to work 1 year as an operational CSO, Chief Scientific Officer of Pfizer's neuroscience division. And I remember seeing incredible things with simulation of drug design inside pockets, you know, where we could kind of move in metaspace. And so where computers do fantastic things is sort of in the detail. That we can simulate protein folding now. We can simulate, we can take all the known drugs we have that are safe in the human body we've known so far. It's a bit experiential, right? Like these drugs have worked on humans for 30 years and they didn't kill people. I mean, there are many examples of which they do. Now, can we find a drug that binds to this particular protein or molecule? And so these becomes efficiencies. But I like the way you say, so a sober, skeptical, really smart person who knows what tools to deploy, I think can be very powerful in the future. And like you said, interact in that way. What I'm excited about is helping people, right? So, and this is how you and I started working together with Biorasi. The interesting thing for me, being trained in medicine, learning about neurological diseases, modeling them, having insights and making discoveries on my team, including patents and things that have gone to clinical trials, is that what I realized working with lots of other biotech groups is that the clinical trial design was weaker than I expected. I came as a student to the table and saying, I want to learn from these people. And with all due respect, I realized that they were fairly formulaic and that the clinical trials were built in a way that it either worked or didn't. And that different drugs with different properties were tested the same way. So one of the reasons I wanted so much to work with your team was that you took this idea of clinical trials in a much more caring way than I was used to. To me, running a clinical trial now is one of the least explored opportunities where you can be successful. And so from the minute I entered industry, and now I'm completely in academia, by the way, because I find it so rewarding, is that we didn't have biomarkers. We did not have anything outside of the patient's report that could help us test what we call surrogate biomarkers. And to this day, and what I said to you earlier, when I now look very critically at what data is available to test the drug, it's not there. And so that human effort of getting gene expression data, blood markers, specific data for specific indications, you know, whereas we're all getting excited about imaging for many decades, like the genomics revolution, now we have AI. It is glacial to my imagination, because I would like to have the patient's biomarkers. Let's say not just one. For example, in Alzheimer's disease, there's something called amyloid that you can measure by PET, but it's very frustrating for those of us who work on other systems that are preceding that tombstone outcome. And, you know, most people will kind of frown and say, well, I don't know what you're talking about. And that's fine, because the reality is that if we had 10 biomarkers for an Alzheimer's patient, we could probably titrate them like we do with heart disease and we do with cancer, right? So for those who are listening who are in those fields, you may feel that the frustration or lack of success in neuroscience is sort of a prelude, right, to what they have accomplished.
Yeah, the tools in neurology are almost primitive in comparison, aren't they, in terms of the sophistication of what's happened in cancer, for example.
And no offense, right? I mean, I spoke to a colleague this morning who said, look, in cancer biology, we take out the tumor. We can't take out the brain.
Yeah.
We can't take out the brain.
That's true. You could, but the consequences are dire.
But, the consequences are dire. And when you have a cellular, very complicated system, and one of the reasons I love neurology and neuroscience, that it's complex. You have to keep a lot of variables in mind at all time, and you have to see them play out, right? So if you're interested in complexity, brain sciences is great. I want to make one more comment, though, which I find interesting for those who are listening and maybe thinking about very abstract things. It's a risk, right? Your analogy was, you know, if you have an interface between a computer program solving chess and humans, it gets better. But what I have found over the years, and I work with many who are mathematicians, I work with many people who have that proclivity, and even, you know, Zach Cohen said, you know, I realized medicine was not science, so I went to MIT.
Yes.
So I find, for those who enjoy this, right, that when you have a rule-based system, and I remember during chess, it is entirely rule-based. There's always a derivation of a problem, even though the cloud of possibilities increases. I'll tell you what, one of my fascinations of being in biology is that there is what is known as an informal system there. I mean, Darwin used to say, you know, things changes, right? So a rule-based system is typically axiomatic, and you have, you know, for those who are good at mathematics, you deduce. You have an axiomatic statement, you test it, you fail it. In biology and medicine, I have found that I enjoy it because it doesn't give me that choice. And people who did the genetics were usually my mathematician's friend, and they would put me on a board to say, Ulla, you explain this to us, okay, please? How does this gene work like this? So, you know, it takes a very intricate team to solve these problems. And I think in a funny way, your question makes me think that these AI systems that we use on our teams now at MGH or at Harvard or within the other teams that I work with, we're all better. We're all faster. We're all having knowledge accessible at all times. And as I said, that user interface is more exhilarating than ever for me. But I am very happy you brought up in this era, right, that the limitations, we're not talking about cryptocurrency, but remember, that was going to solve everything as well, right? That systems that compete each other. So I think the idea here is that we have to evolve with these computer systems. And if we lose track of the patient in the discovery process, or we lose track of any of the opportunities presented by the incredible power of these calculations or computations, we're not going to succeed more than we did before.
Hi, this is Chris O'Brien, host of Few and Far Between. We'll be right back with this episode in a moment. I personally want to thank you for listening to our podcast. Now in our fourth season, it continues to be an amazing opportunity to speak with some of the top thought leaders in the clinical trials industry. If you're enjoying this episode, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps people discover the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to Few and Far Between so that you never miss an episode. One last request, know someone with a great story you'd like to hear me interview? Reach out to us at fewandfarbetween@biorossi.com. Thank you. And now back to the podcast. You made a really profound point that about rules-based versus non-rules-based. It's maybe not fair to call biology non-rules-based, but it is not
informal.
Fully rules-based.
It's more informal.
Yeah, it's informal. I like that descriptor. And that, I think, gets back to this point, the comment from the NVIDIA CEO. In a rules-based world, even a really complicated set of rules, technology can get to an answer. AI systems can get to an answer. And I think part of the frustration with biology that computer scientists sometimes have with biology is that it's informal. So you get directional rather than necessarily concrete yes/no answers to things. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's a powerful thing to keep in mind as we continue on this journey, all of us.
Yeah. No, I think that's probably an essence, the message here, right? And from the idea also of thinking like a doctor, each human, and it's sort of almost the way we have as a value system in our society too, is that a good doctor realizes that there are differences. Now, therefore, you and certainly I've worked with Bayesian logic too, right? You can reverse engineer, you can simulate. But even in that sphere, the clarity and the success, I think, is going to be using models that say, I have enough information to simulate this patient's condition in a way that I get predictions that I didn't have 10 years ago. And I would love to see that in my life.
Yeah, meaningful. Meaning,
you know, like we take blood pressure for granted, we take heart rate variations for granted, and cholesterol, and you can name it, right? Calcium fluctuations. I used to be very interested in heart disease when I started medical school. But what I look forward to is where we have so many markers, if you will, so many data sets that the computer will say, look, I would like to have 10 more, not diagnostic tests, but I would like to have 10 more data points to be able to build a simulation model that will help your patient. When that happens, we're going to transform medicine.
So when you think about the next 5 years, say, and you think about the different components of the, let's call it sort of the drug development pipeline in neuroscience, are you most excited about access to more of these data points, you know, biomarkers and the like, the, you know, sort of increasing complexity of the data you can manage, the sophistication of the algorithms, or do you move more towards how can we simplify the clinical trial process to get to a signal on this drug? Or is it all of it? I'm interested in what excites you the most.
Yeah, that was a great segue. When you started telling me that, I realized that I want all of it. And I also realized that, you know, we live in the present, right? So if I'm confronted with a problem solving for, say, Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's, Lewy body dementia, ALS, and Huntington's disease, and you name it, even epilepsy, I start exactly where I am. It's the humbling position, right? And when I am fortunate to work with very strong teams, what I try to do is to keep a clear head, right? For example, if we have a paradigm in which we realize that the patients fall into a very clear genetic category, having said that, genomics, did it solve any specific problem? Actually, no, but it helped. So if I can identify that group, and I think, you know, this is a discussion we've had before about rare disease, but I mean, in a way, to my paradigm, right, each person is a rare disease, and I mean that. And I mean that personalized medicine is not just a concept, but it is a concept right now because we all talk about it, but very few of us can practice it.
Right.
What I'm trying to say is actually that it's all of the above. If I start with drug discovery today, I start with where I can. It is imagining correctly where I get to the patients most effectively. And so the teams are built by molecular biologists, geneticists, people who have done the drug discovery and look at you with a chemist point of view and wrinkle forehead and said, you guys do not know what you're talking about. Meaning they understand how many things right. go wrong. Putting a synthetic molecule into biological systems, I had that epiphany many years ago when somebody said every molecule is an invention. I thought, this man is right. Chemistry is not what the biology was built for. It was built through genetic interaction with the environment. So every drug you put through your body is an experiment, right? So this is mind-boggling. However, now, when I work with those teams, they work together to solve problems on a daily basis. Then, you know, they have a clinical trial design, which you and I have discussed. That can be genius, lucky, or genius, unlucky. The way you select those patients and you actually iterate, right, through phase 1, 2, 3, or whatever you do. And as I said, I dream of better biomarkers. And people say, we got them, you know. Sometimes they are fooling themselves or we are fooling each other, you know, a biomarker here and there or something. This holistic view that I try to get to is not always there. But the dream I have is to put these components to work more effectively. You select smaller patient groups. I always say for Alzheimer's disease, look, there's millions, tens, 20 millions. Why don't we solve 500,000, please, instead of trying to do all
right,
of it?
Right, right.
So that, you know, your rare disease grouping also at Bio-Rasi and so on. You need to start, I believe we need to start thinking along those lines. I actually also would like to see people crossing from genetics to what we would call idiopathic, say, in neurology, right? Many of the diseases I study, like Parkinson's disease, has a genetic risk. Then the genetic risk is copied, can you believe it, by aging. And I have the hardest time in my talks when I say, and when we looked at this patient population, they simulated this genetic defect. There's silence usually in the audience. And they asked me correctly,
right.
What does that mean? I said, they acquired the genetic change by age. So now you can think through that problem. But it's also an opportunity, meaning if you understand that kind of biology in medicine, it makes it so much of an opportunity to figure out ways of aligning those biomarkers, right? So that not just your genetic small subgroup, which is how we trained on rare diseases, but that, oh, maybe your population of Parkinson's disease actually have a simulation of the things that people are born with that makes them at risk. And that gives me hope for having clinical trial design with not just one biomarker, but a few, and that eventually the entire medical system, and you see that in Europe in particular, right? But also in America with insurance-based systems, right? That UK Biobank, European Registry, Natural History Registry.
These large data sets.
ALS.
Yeah.
That they are become powerful. And what I would like to see is the horizon, right? That when those natural history sets, meaning what is the patient presenting with in their progression, that once we know those data points, I think suddenly, you know, there will be a spotlight on and many drugs can fall into place faster.
Interesting. So the hope then would be that that day comes and suddenly the combination of these different assets, the data and the technology coming together, might unlock a bunch of solutions. That's the hope, I guess. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. And I think, you know, to come back to our starting point, that artificial intelligence is a tool that really levels up and creates an almost like an equity for everybody to participate and use those tools when used effectively to really accelerate medicine's development.
Well, a final question. So if a young person is listening to this who has just completed their undergrad or is in graduate school or something like that, and they're thinking about how to climb the curve on, you know, this relationship with artificial intelligence and these tools, do you have any advice for that person? What they ought to do, the kinds of things they ought to be reading, training on, expertise they ought to be trying to acquire, that sort of thing?
That's a great question. I shudder at the idea of giving you a simple answer. The classic answer in any to-do profession, right? And I think of the American unknown statement that we're looking for competence in people. We're looking for what people are good at right here. And we're pretty upfront about it. If they feel, these students, that they have a chance, a talent, is that they train themselves on many things. If I had to restart my career, I probably would have trained more, for example, on computer biology or mathematical biology. At the same time, there is no way I could have become good at this without practicing the entire physiology, understanding medicine, and understanding those limitations, right? So I think the idea is that hopefully through education, people can train in multiple domains, and so that they understand who is the real specialist. If I work with a mathematician, I need to know enough to communicate with them, and you can list all the other ones. So I have to say that we all say it, but it is true, even in your company, right? That it's team-based. And what people do with me in my lab is to realize that they can cross-fertilize. And we actually, to be honest with you, you said we use undergraduates to explain the mathematics to us. They are better trained than we are. And so we have one team where we have a student, and a master's student, who is explaining to us how to build up the ChatGPT.
Fantastic.
So it's a continuous learning paradigm. And I think what people who are experienced like myself do, we provide perspective and we show what the limitations are, but we certainly stay open to innovation, right? So I think in an interesting way, the people I work with who are students are fascinated by biology. They're a little bit more informal, right? And they are clever and smart to realize then, you know, what the limitations are. So, you know, it'll be fascinating to see how that generation takes full advantage of those new
where it goes. And I think what you're saying that I really like here is there is a need, of course, to specialize in people's careers in any, just about any field, but you're saying, but you have to remain open to and create access points to people who are specialists in related fields, and especially in stuff like this. You're not going to get there if you focus on the biology at the expense of the math and the computer science and the AI tools and all the other stuff that's emerging. Yeah.
That is the reality, Chris. And I think people who can stay on that reality will have all the success. And I think people who veer from that and believe that there are quick, fast answers will find themselves in a little bit of a off the road situation.
Okay. I know I said last question, but I have one more question, which is sort of a big picture one about brain science. And I'm going to ask you for a prediction, and you could say pass if you don't want to give one. But if you sort of think ahead 5 or 10 years, do you think we'll have better answers for diseases like Alzheimer's? You know, are you encouraged by where the science is going now? You know, we have a couple of drugs that have been recently approved, but it's somewhat controversial. And I'm just curious what you think about how these tools will bear fruit and over what time horizon, or is that impossible to say?
Yeah, to stay on subject, I think we have to look at it in at least two ways, right? On the one hand, neuroscience discovery has been the hardest probably in medicine because we talked about the complexity of the data, the diagnostics that was good, interventions are difficult. So they have a rate of discovery that's slower than other more accessible organ systems, if you will. So I don't think that necessarily will change, but the accelerants that I'm excited about could be that even this first success, if you will, of removing amyloid from a brain, which has relatively little impact on the rest of the brain function, unfortunately, is a small step forward. I think it may relax the system a little bit to be open to bigger solutions and accessing and looking at the brain in a way that perhaps many of us do in science already, where the interventions will be looking at brain function and not just removing perhaps a protein that happens to get stuck in a cell somewhere. And once we get a little bit broadening of the field, I think, and we already have seen some successes, there are smaller mid-size neuroscience companies that have found ways of selecting patients, like you and I said, and they are actually very successful with that patient group.
Yep.
If that can be duplicated, not just in rare diseases, but in relatively common diseases where you can isolate a cohort that says, you know, you guys look the same, relatively speaking, biologically, and we can probably treat you with this particular drug. That would be a moment that I would feel aha and very excited and very proud if we're part of it, because that would then change brain diseases to be a little bit more treated like other systems. And so 10 years is a good horizon in the sense that I don't know where the discoveries are going to be made. The frustrating part in medicine is that you can hurt patients by a new drug, as you know, in your trial experience too. So 3 or 4, 4 or 5 years are difficult to really predict. But I believe somewhere along that 10-year line will be an acceleration where some of the chips will fall. And people say, we can treat 400,000 patients with Alzheimer's disease or 200, and we can treat them extremely well at this stage of disease and at this stage of disease with a completely different drug. When that happens, I think we're entering a period where discovery is going to be more rapid. And wrapping it up, of course, with a much bigger question is that since most of my field is with age-related diseases, as I mentioned, you know, they start at a certain time, that the most difficult data set to get to from a societal perspective is how people are healthy and when they get off the healthy track, right, as we say. So that's something that my lab and others are really interested in. So we may probably need to ask governments to say, please give us data on healthy people, not just on people who have a disease.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, look, I think that's an exciting and positive note to end on. I think the idea of Alzheimer's disease being treated not as something monolithic, but as eventually a set of discrete diseases that can be addressed with different tools is a future that I certainly hope to see. Dr. Ella Isaacson, thank you so much for joining us today on Few and Far Between. Thank you for listening to the latest episode of Few and Far Between. Our podcast is now available on Apple Podcasts and other major streaming services. Please take a moment and leave us a user review and rating today. It really helps people discover the podcast, and we read all the comments. Those comments help us to make Few and Far Between better and better. Also, be sure to subscribe to Few and Far Between so that you don't miss a single episode. Got an idea for a future episode? Email us at fewandfarbetween@biorossi.com or contact us on our website at biorossi.com. I'm your host, Chris O'Brien. See you next time.